Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Forget the satellite-guided precision of shock and awe. War remains a brutal business. That's the message in the latest reports from the front lines. This weekend, U.S. ground troops speeding toward Baghdad encountered fierce opposition, took fire, and suffered casualties. Iraqi troops successfully ambushed a U.S. convoy, captured another by staging a phony surrender, and in the latest report, shot down an Apache helicopter. So today, those pictures of the technicolor explosions of smart bombs have been replaced by photos and TV footage of dead, wounded, and terrified American prisoners of war, put in front of the camera to make a propaganda point for their captors. The footage included individual interviews with the prisoners who gave name, rank, and serial number, but little else.
من الولايات المتحدة الأمريكية من مدينة تكساس أتى من عن طريق الكويت.
What's your name?
Sergeant James Riley.
President Bush said he prayed for the families and the loved ones of those killed, and he demanded that the living be treated according to the rules of the Geneva Convention. Connection listeners, does the first sight of American casualties change anything about this war? Does this confused mix of war reporting and propaganda make it hard to figure out who or what is being exploited? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. It's early evening in Baghdad at this hour, and the latest news from Iraq comes from the top U.S. commander, General Tommy Franks. He said just about an hour ago in a briefing that progress has been rapid and in some cases dramatic, that there has been resistance along the way.
Our forces have met sporadic resistance in a number of places on the battlefield. But as our troops fight, even in isolated areas, there will be casualties. There have been casualties because from the perspective of the fighting man on the ground, even an isolated set of combat situations represents violence which he must see face to face.
Joining us now with his view of the attack is Philip Smucker. He's a correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor, and he's joining us now from the field north of Nasiriyah. Hello, Philip.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. I was seeing some reports on the wires that there was a resumption in fighting in Nasiriyah. Tell me what's going on where you are.
The whole region hasn't been secured. It's taking more time than people expected. In Nasiriyah itself, as I understand from the 1st Marine Division headquarters, where I was today, Nasiriyah is continued fighting pockets of resistance, and then all around the area. And going north, there are plans for the Marines to seize an airport this evening, but those plans have been put on hold, which is a suggestion that they are meeting more resistance than they imagine they might.
Phil, it's not clear here whether or not the resistance is coming from civilians who are armed or members of the military who are wearing civilian clothes. Can you shed any light on that?
It's a very confusing situation. What appears to be happening is that guerrilla fighters are disguising themselves in civilian clothes. They're using even the local populace, small children, to slow down convoys and take pot shots at the Americans who are moving north towards Baghdad.
Does it mean, I ask you this question because General Frank said about an hour ago that, yes, in fact, the military was pointedly ignoring certain towns and cities along the way in its push to Baghdad. Does it mean that that sort of plan or philosophy might have to be revised if places like Nasiriyah so far south continue to pose a problem? Phil,
I think that what they're basically trying to do is avoid major confrontations that would create a lot of bloodshed and could backfire in the long run. If this is going to be a long-term peacemaking operation, the Marines, in their planning, have made the point that they want to be seen as liberators and not conquerors. And if they have to take a city like Basra or any other city along the way, it becomes more problematic in the future. So I think, yes, they'd like to decapitate the regime. They'd like to go to Baghdad first. But on the other hand, then they'll be posed with the same problems in these cities where they are meeting resistance further south.
Now, Phil, I understand that you're not embedded with any particular division but traveling on your own. Can you tell us what you're seeing on the road in terms of U.S. military activity? Is there still a lot of trucks and tanks and Humvees moving north?
Oh, yeah, it's a massive column. It's there's a third of the entire Marine Corps moving north to Baghdad. So, I mean, that's an impressive outfit in itself. Today I saw the amphibious assault unit, the massive vehicles moving to Baghdad. It's a bit strange, a lot of the amphibious vehicles driving through the desert. But nevertheless, this is clearly an attempt to overwhelm the Iraqis with even the sight of this massive convoy that's moving north. So I think a lot of it's psychological tactics, just to show them that what America is capable of, and hopefully they won't put up a fight. And so the main fight is being put up by fighters in civilian clothes. A lot of it's pretty classic guerrilla tactics. Remember that Saddam Hussein was a great admirer of Marshal Tito of Yugoslavia, who was one of the greatest guerrilla fighters in the world and commanded Yugoslav units against the Germans. So I think what he's trying to do is take a chapter from the history books and turn this war against the Americans into more of a guerrilla confrontation. And he probably even has anticipated the loss of Baghdad, although that's not clear.
Phil, thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Phil Smucker is a correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor, and you can read his reports from the front line by going to our website at wbur.org. Joining us now from Washington is Thomas Keeney. He's executive director of the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University and an expert on military strategy. He's also a former Air Force officer who commanded a B-52 squadron in Vietnam. Tom, welcome to The Connection.
Thank you.
You've had a chance to listen to both Phil's report from Nasiriyah and a little bit, I gather, of the briefing from General Tommy Franks. I'm interested in your perspective of what we're hearing, what we're seeing from the battle today.
It seems not just today, but in the past several days, what we're really seeing is just very small snapshots of what's going on. The overall picture of what I see the coalition attempting is, on the one hand, air attacks, dramatic, intense air attacks, principally on leadership targets in Baghdad, principally at night, along with attacks of the air defense system. Combined with that, and this is with the journalists, the embedded journalists giving constant reports, is ground attacks coming out of Kuwait and other places up past now Nasiriyah and up towards Baghdad. And the third aspect of this campaign is a psychological operation based on communications with Iraqi leaders, civilian as well as military, and of the Iraqi population. That's a key part of it, because clearly what the strategy is aimed at is not fighting Iraqi military forces. It's getting around them and getting to the leadership.
Although I was reading in a couple of the morning papers some questions about whether or not the psychological operations have been as successful as people were hoping they might. If, in fact, there is civilian response or military dressed as civilian response, it's all, as Phil says, quite hard to know.
Exactly right. In fact, both the air and the ground attacks, it is very hard to know. There are just no real prominent indications of how well you're doing. In a typical, for instance, air campaigns always suffer from this. You just don't know how well you're doing if you're trying to influence the enemy. You won't know it until you're 100% there. For the ground attacks, usually you can count on at least measuring progress along the ground and taking city after city. But here, that's not a good indication either. Here, you're trying to influence the Iraqi population and leadership. You're not trying to take any city, the fact, except perhaps Baghdad. The fact that there's continued fighting in Nasiriyah is a key issue. But one of the key issues is that Nasiriyah in the south, I think the coalition was expecting that there'd be some cheering crowds in Nasiriyah, mm-hmm. and perhaps there will be. But for the time being, they're going to fight through this guerrilla warfare, and I think now progress is uncertain on how well they're doing.
I want to talk a little bit further later in the program about the ground war and some of the grittier propaganda aspects of it. But I do want to pick up on one of the points you made about reviewing the weekend. We do see so much from those reporters, television, radio, print reporters, who are embedded with the troops, that we are then so focused on what's happening along that highway heading north from Kuwait City. If we think about this conflict in context of the NATO attack on Kosovo or the Gulf War in 1991, it seems to me that we're not, other than looking at those long-distance shots in Baghdad, spending a lot of time looking at what the air war part of this conflict is actually doing to change it.
That is correct, and it is very difficult to do that. First of all, I think the indications are that you're looking for are not buildings destroyed. They can show you pictures of that. But since the objective of the air campaign is forcing Saddam's regime out of power, that is based on what the decision process. In other words, you've got to either kill Saddam Hussein and those around him, or somehow convince them that the game is up. And it's very difficult getting information or have reporters get information on that.
So when I look at the photograph in the newspaper that has the little red star around the whatever it is, the defense headquarters in Baghdad, you're saying that's not particularly indicative of either the intention of the air campaign or the type of information that they're using to devise the next day's targeting?
Well, that's correct. In other words, if the Air Defense Headquarters goes out, that's good news for the folks who are trying to fly aircraft in there. In other words, the defense system is shattered or at least damaged. But if you knock out government building after government building, unless you get some very precise information from radio intercepts, phone intercepts, and very discreet indicators, you're really not going to know how well you're doing.
And you put this together with all the news that we're not hearing about the activity of the special forces. And what percentage of the battlefield are we looking at then, Tom? Are we looking at 10%, 30%? What do you think?
I think since the battlefield is the Iraqi population and the Iraqi leadership, you're seeing almost none of that. The reporters can see some of it in the cities that they pass through by the reaction of the population. Some of the reporters in Baghdad can give a little indication. But this, I think, is a campaign that will be decided probably fairly dramatically. You won't know how well you're doing, but eventually, when it does fall, it could happen very quickly. Once public opinion, or once the opinion of the Iraqis have got it in their minds that they are in fact going down, the Iraqi leadership, I think you'll see some very rapid changes. But until then, perhaps nothing.
All right. Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're interested in your thoughts coming after a very busy weekend of war coverage, some of the first sights of American casualties, prisoners of war. And we'll talk a little bit about that mix of war reporting and propaganda. We'd like to hear from you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. With me this hour, Tom Keeney, Executive Director of the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University and an expert on military strategy. And we're taking something of a look back over the weekend where we are now. Tom, I wanted your thought, because you spent time in Vietnam, about the kind of real face of war which appeared this weekend. I'm thinking of the scared faces of the prisoners of war on both sides, and those grainy images of bodies on a highway, as well as a fairly graphic radio report I heard this morning about Iraqi families coming to pick their dead up in villages near Nasiriyah. and wondering whether or not in all the debate and in all the anticipation and talk, the nation wasn't in some way desensitized to, you know, the fact that this was going to be a part of what of what's ahead.
Now, people talked about it, or the government talked about it numerous times, but I think you're correct. No one was able, outside the military, was able to really internalize that we may be seeing casualties on a daily basis. The previous experience in Afghanistan and Kosovo, indicated that casualties weren't necessary, that we could do this without casualties. And just the nature of what was going to be attempted, I think, argued against that in this case.
I know that the foreign ministers from the Arab League are gathering in Cairo for a meeting. The foreign minister of Iraq is there and will be looking for some sort of unanimous support, which he's highly unlikely to get. But Naji Sabri was asked by a BBC reporter about the treatment of and the images of the U.S. prisoners of war. Let's listen to his response.
Are you going to treat them according to the Geneva Convention, these American
prisoners? We are committed. First of all, we are committed to the teachings of Islam. We are faithful Muslims. We are committed to the teachings of Islam. So we take care of prisoners of war in accordance with our teachings of Islam.
And but we not, are the committed. Geneva, not the Geneva we are, Conventions,
no,
though.
We are committed, first of all, to the teachings of Islam. And second, we are committing to the conventions of Geneva in dealing with the prisoners of war.
That's Iraqi Foreign Minister Naji Sabri being questioned at a meeting of Arab League foreign ministers in Cairo. Tom Kinney, give us a little bit of your insight here on what the actual rules are. For example, the difference between seeing those columns of Iraqi soldiers walking down the highway with their hands above their heads images that have been broadcast in America versus the way that the Iraq government was using images of American prisoners of war?
Well, I think based on what the Iraqi minister said, he's said we're going to take care of him based on the tenets of Islam. There's nothing in the tenets of Islam about treatment of prisoners that's in any way contradictory to the Geneva Conventions. He just may have been using that as a cover or a trying to avoid the question. However, the Geneva Conventions, for which the U.S. and Iraq are both party to, clearly define how to handle prisoners. That is, that they are taken apart. That is, they're treated in terms of their food and their care, just as you would your own soldiers. They're not to be used as hostages, not to be used for propaganda.
All right.
Clearly, though, the Iraqis are going to do that. I mean, it comes as no surprise. In other words, what's being combated here is a criminal regime that no one thought was going to fight fair.
It happened in 1991 as well. I remember that. I guess what I'm interested in knowing is where do you draw the line? Because if you open your paper and see a couple of Iraqi soldiers spread-eagled on a highway with somebody pointing a rifle at them, is that not also using that image in a way for propaganda purposes?
Well, certainly you can use the images. It depends on what happens after they're disarmed,
right?
And how they're being treated. And I think that the reporters that will be covering this will probably show in the United States, particularly, will be very definite in trying to showing that the kind of just treatment or fair treatment that the Iraqi prisoners are getting. But clearly, from 1991, the 1991 war, there should have been. No surprise that the Iraqis were not going to reciprocate.
I wonder if it's your expectation that, you know, we'll see more of that, or perhaps an even more dramatic exploitation of that, if the Iraqi leadership begins to see itself squeezed without the sort of military options to try and fight back.
Yes, this is clearly their best hope, is to somehow turn public opinion. You're exactly right. They'll try to put those people on TV. They'll try to get them to say something. They'll just try to show the American forces or the coalition forces as weak and able to be defeated. So the visual images of that will be very powerful.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're interested in your own reaction to the way that the coverage of the war in Iraq is changing, and whether or not it's easy in your mind to make a distinction between war reporting and the exploitation of images. Let's take our first call from South Wellfleet, Massachusetts now. Gabe's on the line. Hi, Gabe.
Hi. Great show. Very important, especially right now. I'm concerned that the propaganda images that the Iraqis are putting on television, you know, of the dead American soldiers and the captured soldiers, may enhearten, you know, the Muslim street, you know, to rise up and fight, and that this war really won't go anywhere near as easy as the American propaganda has asked us to believe.
When you talk about the Muslim street, Gabe, are you talking about people outside Iraq? Are you talking
both.
About inspiring
both.
People? Yeah,
I think it will unite them. It makes it a much larger issue, so that you know they may their hatred for America and the West may override their hatred for Saddam.
Let me ask you a question from coming at it from the other direction. Can you blame them under the circumstances?
Oh, man. I mean, no. I mean, you know, even if they didn't see the images, I think there's a lot of other reasons with all the destruction that I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't blame them. I don't blame them, you know. And, you know, I'm terrified of the future for both sides, you know.
Let me ask Tom Keeney to join us on this, because if this could have been foreseen, and Tom, you're saying in effect, most people who had thought about this knew it was coming. Is there a way of countering that, of dealing with those types of images, or is this part of the sort of spine stiffening that comes along with an acknowledgement of just what the United States is involved in here?
Well, I think on the only way to once they decided they were going to commit ground forces, there was air forces, there was the danger of having prisoners taken.
Right.
What they can do is what they I think the administration has done is that is first of all is point out that this is a war crime and these people will be held liable in exactly the same way as they're trying to avoid the use of chemical or biological weapons. In other words, pointing out to the Iraqis involved that they will be held as criminals, that they will the United States will prevail and they will be held criminally liable afterwards.
All right, Gabe, thanks a lot for your call. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Providence, Rhode Island, and Hirak is joining us. Hi, Hirak.
Hi, Dick. Excellent program. I got a question that you were reporting about the Iraqis showing our POWs, but you are not reporting. We are showing them their POWs, and there is a both sides. And I want to hear what Mr. Keeney had to say. That Geneva Convention, according to the Geneva Convention, we are equally. Having a propaganda by showing these guys with their hands up, and that has some kind of reaction to the Arab world, especially Iraqi. Equally, we are showing our POWs. Where is it going?
Mm-hmm. Iraq, let's ask Tom to help us out on that, because it's something that puzzles me as well. Can you, Tom, help us understand the difference between the soldiers with their hands up and the video camera that is 3 feet away from a prisoner of war asking him questions?
Well, it's at this point it is difficult to tell what is going on. I agree with the listener, the speaker, that both sides are engaged in a propaganda war. That's clearly the case. I think the difference is. Particularly on these handheld cameras of the people interviewing the prisoners of war, it was more the images of the dead prisoners next to them, with the implication that they had been assassinated. In other words, they had been killed after capture. The image of people giving their names on a video cam is not clear evidence that there's been any sort of violence done against them, or that there will be. So that is clearly that's not a war crime.
Iraq, back to you.
But in 1991, we showed a lot of dead Iraqis or dead Kuwaitis. And my point is, doesn't matter how much each side show, the casualty is always going to be there.
Iraq, let me just ask you give me your perspective on the difference between the coverage of a battlefield from a a media that moves about and does whatever it wants to do, and one that is a state media. Because if I think of those pictures taken of the Iraqi soldiers who died in their tanks along the highway in southern Iraq back in 1991, my recollection is that those weren't necessarily distributed by the White House or the Pentagon. Those were reporters in doing their jobs. In fact, they kind of annoyed the American politicians because they showed that war had kind of a grisly face to it on the ground. Whereas in Iraq, we know that anything that comes out with the stamp of the state on it.
Yeah, but Al Jazeera showed that, and Pentagon asked them not to show. That was an independent TV people. But the point, what I was trying to say, Dick, that we are trying to make our way, but except the Christian Science Monitor, I think ABC, CBS, NBC, we are all on our side, just like Al Jazeera is in their side.
Yeah.
There is no independent. The first time I heard that Christian Science Monitor, a few minutes ago you did, he was more close to independent than biased reaction, his personal opinion. And I think that's what we need to make the perception that who is breaking the Geneva Convention. In this situation, there is always some overlapping situation that one will exaggerate, the other will not.
No, Hirak, you're quite right. It's so much in the eye of the beholder, which is why we wanted to try and deal with some of the aspects of it. You make the observation of Al Jazeera, which operates as an independent media organization, according to its claim, much less so in the eyes of others. And you know, of course, we could argue about the way that the Arab world would look at Fox TV and find ourselves in an argument that would never end. But there was a moment yesterday in the Central Command briefing when the U.S. General Abizaid was asked a question by the Al Jazeera reporter, which gives you an indication of that kind of tension.
You're from Al Jazeera Television. I'm very disappointed that you would portray those pictures of our servicemen. I saw that, and I would ask others not to do that.
Can you envision a situation in which you would come to regard Al Jazeera as hostile media?
No, I don't regard any media as hostile media. I regard...
Even if they continue to show pictures like that, even if you continue to have that kind of exchange every night?
I regard the showing of those pictures as absolutely unacceptable.
Let's go back to Tom Keeney in Washington. Tom, the decision about what to watch and who's got it right and where the propaganda is gets, in fact, more complicated the more you look at it.
Exactly right. And one thing I would make a clear difference between, obviously, is the Western journalists or the world journalists that are reporting on the war held up against the tapes or whatever information is coming out of the Iraqi-controlled ministries. Those simply are not the same, and I don't think anyone, any fair-minded person would think that you're going to hear anything contrary or anything except propaganda from the Iraqi military. It's been clear that for the journalists that are traveling with the on the ground forces, that is, they can say what they want. Clearly, there's information that they're not allowed to say in terms of where they are,
mm-hmm.
but I think it is going to be an open situation about how the treatment of the Iraqi prisoners is going. I think you certainly can't say the same thing about the American prisoners.
I've certainly been struck by the frequency of the reports and the speed with which they're coming out. I know in anticipation of this, we talked on this program and with other people about whether or not those people would be allowed to say anything. And if you think, Tom, for a minute about the weekend incident when one soldier who is thought to have been a member of the 101st who attacked his comrades. That story, that footage, the sort of reactions and interviews was there within hours.
Exactly right. And truly a frightening image, that is, of senior leadership, the senior army leadership of that division being attacked by their own soldier. And the fact that it came out very quickly. Now, obviously, the United States was very quick to point out that this was a disgruntled soldier. However, a disgruntled soldier who, it's been reported, didn't agree with the war in 1991, a Muslim soldier, unknown motives, was a very disturbing picture.
Well, it's also going to raise some questions in the minds of soldiers throughout the region in terms of who's sleeping next to them and whether or not they can be as open and free as they might have felt they could have been.
Yeah, exactly right. Now, this clearly could have been a lone individual working with his own personal demons for his own ends. However, the fact that he was a Muslim obviously complicates the picture.
I'm thinking also of Vietnam. You served there, and there were dozens, perhaps a couple of hundred incidents in Vietnam where a soldier from within his own unit would get involved in some kind of altercation, frequently ending in the death of another soldier. Should we look at this as something extremely unusual? Give us your perspective on that from having seen it before.
I think extremely unusual. The comparison with Vietnam, in Vietnam there were without doubt units and soldiers within those units that were clearly rebellious, that didn't want to be there,
right.
That were willing to take action against against officers. In this case, I think you can see from the journalists, I think unanimously the journalists have reported the high morale of all the different Marine and Army units there. So in this case, it really was a shock. That is, everyone seemed to be really motivated towards what they were up to.
Worth noting, I suppose, the difference in the two battles between the conscription force in Vietnam and the volunteer force that's here.
Exactly right.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. As we've been mentioning on the program so far, a very busy and at times quite disturbing weekend of news as the idea of a war in Iraq became a whole lot more than an idea as the stories began showing up on radio of Americans killed in battle, killed in friendly fire, journalists disappeared, missing, and we're interested in how you see the picture of the battlefield at this point. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Our number's 1-800-423-TALK. Tom Keeney is with me now. Tom, I gather that I got your title a little bit wrong earlier in the program. I'm going to say now that you are Executive Director of the Foreign Policy Institute at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins and ask you, have I got it right?
Exactly right. Thanks.
Okay. Sorry about that earlier. Let's go to Boston, Massachusetts now, and Christian is joining us. Hi, Christian.
Yes. Good morning, gentlemen. I was thinking about during the Afghani war, when John Walker Lynn was fighting with the Taliban, and he was captured, and they showed him on TV. He was wounded, and he was on the stretcher, and he was all over the news. And I'm wondering why not showing the POW, and is there a contradiction here?
Contradiction in what way?
What is the difference? I mean, he was fighting, and he was wounded, and he was shot twice. And I think he showed that he was treated perhaps inhumanely. And
inhumanely by the journalists, you mean, or inhumanely by those who captured him?
By those who captured him, I think.
Yeah, I certainly remember the moment, Christian. I would imagine part of the answer to your question is that it came as such a thunderbolt to people living in this country that there was an American fighting with the Al-Qaeda forces. Would that be part of the explanation?
It doesn't matter. I think it should be just. You know, a soldier is a soldier and a combatant is a combatant. And he's responsible for his own actions.
And both sides are responsible for maintaining certain standards of decorum in dealing with prisoners of war. It goes, Tom Keeney, it goes up and down, I guess.
Well, I think it's a little bit different. First of all, with John Lind, I don't recall from the images the fact that people took pictures of him and they got them and that got on television doesn't mean that the United States government were the ones who sponsored that. That is a clear difference. in terms of how you treat the enemy. But recall that these were not lawful combatants, according to the Geneva Convention. That is, they're still being held in Guantanamo. They're not being treated as prisoners of war. That's maybe a little side view off the track of what we're talking about in this war. But the al-Qaeda members that were taken were not considered as prisoners of war and were not entitled and still are not entitled to the rules that affect prisoners of war.
I wonder if the distinction that you're making, though, is as clear in some of the Arab countries as it appears in this country, the notion that the people being held at Guantanamo Bay somehow don't qualify for any considerations under the Geneva Conventions, and whether or not that sort of stokes the resentment against the United States.
Well, I think clearly they are covered by the Geneva Conventions. They're just not covered as lawful combatants. In other words, they can be tried separately. This is the United States position.
Right.
And I agree throughout much of the Muslim world, people look at that as a legalism. In fact, in any sort of civil war, the idea of one side having uniforms and the requirement for uniforms, et cetera, you have what turns out to be violations of the Geneva Conventions. And it clearly in this war, we're seeing the same thing.
All right. Christian, thanks for that call. Let's go to Nash County, North Carolina now. And Michael's on the line. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Appreciate you taking my call. Am I on air?
Yes, you are. Go ahead.
Okay, my question is this, and this has to do with given the psychological aspect of the war is such a dominant part of the military strategy, in conjunction with that, let me just say that I do recognize we have great minds running our military, but I find it somewhat... I'm just baffled at what is the point of, given that the objective of the psychological warfare is to demoralize the Iraqi military into a point of maybe wanting to give up or surrender and disrupt their anything that would encourage them to continue to fight. And hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, anyways, and understanding that, knowing that, and then understanding that we have a remarkable ability militarily to be able to take out very specific targets.
For example, a television station, right?
There you go.
Yeah.
And in other words, by allowing these broadcasts to continue, it seems like we would, I'm talking about Iraqi televised state-run images that, or state supported, that it would, if I was an Iraqi soldier, it would just increase my morale because I want to believe what I see.
Right. I know, Tom Kinney, that in 1991, some of the targets, like the television station, were among the first hit.
Yes.
Why was it? Why do you suppose it's been left alone this time around?
I don't know. I don't know how much those targets, they have been the subject of targeting. It seems to me, though, that they would, I believe they did initially, they would like to override the signal. In other words, to proclaim on the basis that the coalition is in charge, and to not allow the Iraqis to transmit and to motivate their people. Whether that has been really successful, or whether it's really possible—that is, you can put television towers in some places that, in the middle of civilian neighborhoods, where
right.
The coalition is just not willing to attack.
Actually, we are just getting a report in now from the BBC that saying that their journalists have talked about this with the U.S. authorities, and that the television towers are going to become a greater focus of the air war. Do they have? This is something, Tom, that you can help me with, because there have been at the same time reports this morning, you may have seen some of them, about the Iraqi administration actually bringing civilians into the area of places that they're anticipating will be targeted. And if, in fact, the television tower qualifies for something like this, What's your understanding of just how precise these satellite-guided weapons can be in terms of going after something like that without necessarily putting a great number of people at risk at the same time?
That's. I'll just qualify the question by saying that, first of all, the weapons are very precise.
Right.
They advertise them within 30 feet or so. They're probably much better than that. But it's very dependent on each target about what is in the vicinity. Now, clearly, the Iraqis are trying to make it as difficult as possible by bringing hostages in and putting them at not just television towers but military targets and screening their own forces. So that does make it difficult, very difficult.
All right, Michael, I hope that answers your question. 1-800-423-8255 to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Now David's joining us. Hi, David.
How you doing?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
My question is, couldn't this whole thing backfire on the Iraqis? And I ask that from the standpoint of I'm not in the military. I've never been in the military. But when I hear about what's happening to our troops over there, isn't that something that's going to stiffen resolve from our side? I mean, I was ambivalent about us getting into this war, but now I'm not so sure.
Well, we can talk about public reaction on in this country, but Tom Keeney, maybe you can tell me what the impact or the effect of you know, seeing military comrades being exploited on television, like the Iraqi television, what the effect of that will be for the people who are in the theater.
Well, I agree with the caller. It's going to have an effect. It's going to stiffen the resolve, and not particularly of the soldiers in the theater. I don't think they need any stiffening.
Right.
I think it perhaps could have an effect on the people in the United States, on who are because there is a curious division that is people who really argue against the war,
yep,
but support the troops. Those folks who are against the war and supporting the troops and see the treatment of those troops, I think it could tone down the rhetoric of their anti-war rhetoric also.
Well, David, what about your perspective here? You said that it's changing your mind. In what way is it changing your mind?
Well, when we first started, I mean, I wasn't quite so sure this was the right thing to do. You know, I've got a son who's 17 years old, and I have concerns, you know, a little bit about the Vietnam era and so forth. But, you know, I do support the troops, and I do believe that they deserve all of our support. And to see something, well, I haven't seen it, obviously, but to hear about what's happening to them makes me feel like we should go in even stronger, that we should get behind Bush further, and we should throw everything that we need to so this doesn't continue happening to our troops.
Tell me, David, in the days leading up to this moment, did you not think that this might happen? I mean, do you think perhaps we've been lulled into a sense, as Tom Keeney was saying earlier in the program, that a war can happen and we don't either see these images or in some sense pretend that that's not a part of it?
I guess a part of me thought that this something like this was going to happen.
Yeah.
You hope that it won't happen. But I heard some of the military people say that this kind of, you know, bloodshed happens when you get what they call boots on the ground. And every war we've had or every military engagement we've had over the last 20 years has been done from a far distance. And I think most of the people in this country aren't used to seeing our soldiers getting shot and our soldiers getting taken prisoner of war. It's a fact. That doesn't make it right. That doesn't make it any easier to take, but I think it's a fact.
Tom Keeney, your thoughts on Dave's observation there?
It is a phenomena that will take place. That is, casualties sometimes steal the nerve, and they will affect subsequent decision making. That is, the more casualties the United States takes, there's no doubt in my mind that the U.S. decision makers are going to be all the more firm in prosecuting this war. There's no doubt in my mind about that.
And from your perspective as head of a foreign policy institute, does this take the United States in a direction which is separate from other countries when your own citizens begin appearing on television as these young soldiers have in Iraq? You know, I'm trying to imagine seeing this on television in Europe, where they might be saying, well, there are the American prisoners of war and there are the Iraqi prisoners of war. Does this, in a sense, divide the United States from other countries when people start to see their own citizens in situations like that?
It divides the United States from those who are not participating in terms of their commitment to it. I wouldn't say that in terms of subsequent foreign policy it will be seen in any different light. But clearly casualties make a difference. Casualties steal, obviously to a certain degree, casualties steal the resolve of those people undertaking it. Going back to the Vietnam War, as we took more casualties, the administrations in charge became more and more committed to not giving up. In other words, is to pushing onward. And that war continued year after year. And you're less likely to make decisions based on the actual facts as opposed to trying to recoup the losses that you've undergone.
But there comes, I presume, some sort of tipping point, because if we use the Vietnam example, then public support for the war diminished. People weren't more encouraged as they saw more and more of the death in that part of the world.
Exactly right. And I think there are tipping points. There's tipping points. I think with the military advantage of the U.S., it's not a Vietnam War type scenario. But clearly there's a tipping point. And what the coalition is looking for is that Iraqi tipping point. And the more rapidly that takes place, the better it's going to be, because they want to have the Iraqis convinced that they don't want to take any more casualties and that the regime is lost.
Tom Keeney, thanks so much for your perspective.
You're welcome.
Tom Keeney is Executive Director of the Foreign Policy Institute at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins. Earlier in the program, we talked with Philip Smucker, who's a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He talked to us from just north of Nasiriyah in Iraq. To continue the conversation, we invite you to our forums. We're at www.theconnection.org. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Gail Harris, Kelly Jones, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.